Session number 27074, Reel 9.
Squadron Leader Cyril Bamberger, Reel 9. Squadron Leader, you just told me about communication, obviously, once you got into the air.
Well, along with the other things you had to do, you had to switch the radio on. And when you got airborne, probably the first communication was the squadron leader using the squadron call sign, communicating with control, saying something like, have you any information for me? And if, because you'd been scrambled, you'd thought there was a reason for it, obviously. And quite often, the controller would say, we have 20 bandits coming in at such and such a height and such a course. And he'd say to the squadron, vector 180 degrees. And so everyone was listening to this, you'd all know what was going on. Now then, it depended on the squadron leader and the squadron. You may get, say, one flight commander wanted to address the CO, or a squadron leader wanted to show his authority, saying, keep up Red 3, close up Red 3. But as there was much more important things for the radio to be used for, so I saving your life, it wasn't the order of the day. It was something like that. It was very, very infrequent. Then you get another instruction or an inquiry from the controller. Bandits reported so-and-so should be in your vicinity. Can you see them? And the answer was probably nothing yet, nothing yet. Gaining heights, because they'd probably given a height for the 109, certainly over in excess of 25,000. And the squadron leader would say, well, we're still at 16,000 and still climbing. And so in other words, you could actually be climbing up and they'd pass over you and you'd be climbing one way, they'd be climbing the other. They'd even miss you, you see. And there were one or two brief, can't we? And then the control may come up. I've no further information for you. Climb to 30,000 feet on a course heading for Dungeness or something like that. And so then you do that thing. And then a call may come up. There should be something interesting for you if you fly so on and so forth. And you may find something interesting. It just depended. Well, sometimes, I mean, you just landed and nothing has happened. You asked about communications. And I think I'm talking about September now, September time. Later September, when in his wisdom, the CNC, Dowding, decided to let loose the poles. And the poles would chatter between one another. And they'd block all communications. And as it was in Polish, it didn't mean anything to anybody. And you'd hear then the CEO of the squadron, who was normally an English at that time, an Englishman, saying, shut up, cut out. But he couldn't be heard because they were all talking, you see. So That was the only time when some of these other French or got airborne, that the airwaves were jammed, and that was an inconvenience.
Because it sounds like you kept quite strict discipline as to who would speak once in the air.
Normally, except normally the average pilot wouldn't say a word from takeoff to touchdown unless he had engine problems or, the main thing, if he saw enemy aircraft. There was virtually no chit chat at all. I mean, it was just forbidden, and it was risking your life as well. So you wanted the airways free.
Would it be important then for the first person who saw the enemy formation to shout out there they are and give direction?
Very much so. Because some people had that allied talent of being able to focus their eyes in the air. Looking into infinity blankly, you won't see anything. You've got to focus your eyes. Though you're looking at a blank space or a blank sheet sort of thing in the sky, you still had to try and focus at a distance where you could see something.
You said that as a talent. Is it a talent, or is it something that you can train your eyes to do?
You can train your eyes to do, but normally there's always two or three people that were better than other people. But with experience, you improved.
Is there anything that you can do to improve that sight?
Certainly, I never heard of anyone attempting it or doing anything to along those lines. But as I may have mentioned to you before, it was believed, say, Australians who lived in the outback, places like that, were far better at picking up things in the distance than the average English townie.
You mentioned with the radio communication, once a formation had been spotted, would the squadron leader or the flight commander, would they then issue an order to attack?
I've again got to go back to both the squadrons I was in. Our specific instructions was to look after the enemy fighters. And I cannot recollect one occasion when either of the COs or three COs I flew with ever said there's formation down on the port side, so 3 miles away, I'll attack first and red section of attacks out. Anything like that. Never did I ever see. The only thing I can recollect is someone in the squadron shouted break. Unless there was something was at a distance high up, and then someone may point that out. But normally, after that had been pointed out, those they were coming into attack, and the order was always break. That's why there was so much chaos, you see. That was almost a standard order from the CO, break. Because you were no use in this close formation, so you broke up.
You mentioned if something had been spotted higher up.
Yeah.
How would you give direction to that formation?
Well, they normally say 109's 3 o'clock high or something like that.
Because obviously I was thinking there of certainly in the years since the Second World War, there is a perception of much more radio communication taking place in the air than you seem to be saying.
No.
You seem to have said to me that that would be dangerous to do that amount of...
You can't allow chatter at all, because you miss the vital information. And the vital information was coming from the controller and the CO.
Can I ask you a little bit about both the squadrons? Because you did mention your first day when you arrived with 610 Squadron at Hawkinge. Could you tell me a little bit about operating from Hawkinge as a forward air station?
Well, flying from Hawkinge, you flew down there and stayed there for the day. You didn't stay there overnight. And I think the idea was that you were sort of nearer the enemy and sort of thing. But it wasn't a great advantage. I don't think it saved much fuel. and... though you were closer to them, if they were still high up, it wasn't a great advantage. And as I think, I mentioned to you, nearly all my brief flying, because I was only with 610 Squadron for about 2 weeks, were listed in my logbook as patrols. So we were down there, and we took off and went on patrols. I suppose... in some ways, we broke up attacks being down there rather than sending something from someone from further inland to break up the attacks. But that's probably why we never made the height, and they were always above us, but we were there enough to disturb them. It never happened when I was there. But the big guns, the Calais, I think they were, shelled both Dover and Hawkinge, which is just at the back of Dover, on a number of occasions. And of course, it was a target from time to time for the German bombers. Probably, again, this is just maybe of historical interest. One time when I was at Hawkinge, four of us went down, and a New Zealander was leading the four of us, and he went for a briefing. And on the airfield was an Anson, which you know is very slow. To this day, I can't tell you what it was actually doing, but I think it was trying to spot these big guns, I think. But he came back, he said, we've got to escort an Anson across the channel, or as far as he wanted to go nearest. Because I presume he had cameras aboard or something. Which was the most stupid idea. Who'd thought it up, I don't know, that they could send an Anson across the channel at that time. But okay, we took off and the Anson climbed to about 2,000 feet. One little interesting remark here, which is to do with war. At times, people disappeared from squadrons. I don't mean shot down, they just were brought down. Well, instead of four of us taking off, only three of us took off. And off we went, escorting this Anson across the channel. I don't know how far we'd gone across the channel. I don't know, say three quarters way across the channel. When, as we expected, all hell broke loose. There was more 109s than bees around us. And the Anson returned home, and our job was protected. Well, it was virtually asking the impossible. We buzzed round its tail. But the only really thing we could do to stop being shot down ourselves again, because as well as self-preservation comes into it, if I'd have flown alongside that ant or anything like that, I just got shot down. If I flew some distance from it, the long shot, I still get shot down. So I think, like the other three, I can't remember, I don't think I ever discussed it with them. I went right down on the sea till my propeller virtually did it, knowing that if the 109 wanted to get me, he'd have to risk flying into the sea or get above it. And then every now and then I'd just turn round and do the same again, right on the sea. And the Anson didn't do what it was supposed to do. All three of us got back. One person in the Anson was killed, and it crashed, landed. Possibly the most interesting thing is the person, I couldn't remember his name, he asked me, the person who didn't take off left the squadron.
When that action was occurring, did the Anson, did it drop to sea level as well with
you? Oh yes, yes, he dropped to sea level. He could go lower than we could. But it was, as I say, using it as a forward base, to me, I don't think it was really, except it was another airfield. You could disperse your aircraft. It's that factor.
How would you climb? I'm thinking of the direction you would take off from when you when you're at the airfield. Would you go inland and climb, or would you go up to sea?
No, we'd go up and down the coast.
Because you mentioned obviously that you were trying to climb all the time.
The Maidstone Dungeness Patrol Line, I think that's the one we went on to mostly. Maidstone Dungeness Patrol Line.
And what facilities were available for you on the airfield? Because it was obviously a satellite airfield, wasn't it?
Personally, I never used any facilities. I may have used a hedge.
Was there a NAFI van or something of that sort?
I cannot remember at all.
Because a lot of the image you see of the Battle of Britain is of pilots sitting around on the grass or by the dispersal hall.
Yeah.
Would that be an image that was what you remember at that time?
Fair image. Though what's missing from some of those photographs or illustrations or film, they're always doing demonstrations of a scramble, which make me feel sick from time to time. But I think people would be more on their own. I mean, what were you going to talk about?
Well, I was thinking about the actual scramble situation. Yeah. How would that occur? Would you be sat at dispersal and how? Because you mentioned a few things about people. You see images of people running with parachutes when you actually said yours was in the aircraft.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of generally setting the scene for how people would be at dispersal waiting for scramble.
Well, it was a nice sunny day, as it seemed virtually every day was a nice sunny day. Regrettably, we used to think time to time. People would lug these chairs out and sit outside. The sun didn't agree with me. I got all burnt up. So normally I sat inside. We used to have some beds in some of the huts. But again, it's a long, long time ago. Most people were involved in their own thoughts or their own book or their own sleeping. They weren't nattering away. There was no... in fact, there's a very well-known photograph of 6'10" squad, and I'm not going to pick them all out, where they're lying on the grass like this and so on and so forth. And it's a lovely photograph. And if it was taken at all, it was taken just after they'd landed. And they were sort of talking about what happened. But the average would be much more, I wouldn't say sitting by yourself, but, you know, sort of, there was no heated conversations going on about anything particular.
You mentioned, obviously, your feelings about when the scramble... Yeah. Telephone would go, but what would actually occur once that telephone went? What would the actions of the pilots then be to get to their aircraft?
Well, I mean, I would do it to really run to the aircraft, because remember, the CO's aircraft and the flight commander's aircraft would be closest to. Mine would be about 100 yards away. So I had to run as fast as I could, get in and make certain I was all ready when everybody else was ready. A bit of an exaggeration, that, but it was. I mean, aircraft were placed in favourite positions. And you just got in your aircraft, helped with by your ground crew. They handed you your straps, you just put them on the point and put them. Things, strap yourself in, and handed you your helmet, and put that on, stand there, shut the cockpit door for you. You know, they did as much as they could for you.
Would they be positioned, obviously, by the aircraft then, but, during that period?
Well, that's why they rang the bell, to make certain they were. But, I mean, quite often they were lying on the grass by the aircraft. We were going through a busy time.
We also mentioned the weather during that period of time. Now, obviously, it's always seen as a brilliant summer.
Yeah.
Was that the case?
As a fighter pilot during the Battle of Britain, it appeared a glorious summer. And I think it was a very good summer. But on the odd occasion, the weather was bad. Always, it was a wonderful sigh of relief. Because sometimes, only sometimes, you were stood down about 6 o'clock. And that was heaven, you know. Because normally it was dawn till dusk you were there. Because it was a long day.
And if you were stood down at 6 o'clock, would there be any opportunities, or would you be too tired for any kind of social activities?
In that respect, I can only talk about myself. Once at Biggin Hill with 6'10", I remember going out, and I was running there for 2 weeks. I cannot remember going out from Hornchurch at all. Again, everyone different. Because one of the problems was at Hornchurch, well, unless you had a car, you couldn't get anywhere. I certainly, and my contemporaries and that, hadn't got cars. So sort of, obviously we had the odd beer, but obviously you didn't, half a beer would probably be my maximum, I should think, in those days.
And would there be much mixing, obviously, between the officers and the sergeants, or would you have a...
Not at all, like? Completely. I think that was one of the, again, it's always hindsight. I can take it on. When I was a sort of CO flight commander, there was still this gap. And so I know what I talked about and what we talked about. And for instance, we'd have the controller coming into our mess. And talk, when I was a an officer, The wing commander will probably drop in. And you were up to date with what was going on, whereas the sergeants didn't know what was going on in many ways at all. So that was, I think, a big weakness right during the war, this separation of the sergeants from the officers. I mean, it's just one of those things. I mean, when I was a sergeant, I had no grudge or animosity or anything to the officers, because that's what I was used to. You know, that was life. But, looking at it with hindsight, the sergeants would have known a little bit more what was going on. I mean, for instance, if someone had said to me during the Battle of Britain that a 109 could only stay over the country for 20 minutes, I'd have jumped for joy. But no one mentioned it to me, so I didn't know. And there was other things like that that I've learned from books that have I known about the performance of the 109 and the problems and things. I don't talk about German tactics now, I'm just talking about basics that we should have been briefed on. Now, whether all the officers knew it, I couldn't say. But knowing how, when I was an officer, how we operated, in the officers' mess, we were much, much better briefed and informed than the sergeants were.
Was there much discussion, obviously, you mentioned a little bit there, among, say, your fellow sergeants during that period, about tactics and experience and that sort of thing in the evenings after?
No. It was shut the hangar doors and that was it.
So there wasn't long discussions about
do? No.
Would you pass on experience to, obviously, the new pilots at all, or would they learn as you'd learned by experience?
I think they just... I mean, I'd take myself. I wouldn't have had the audacity to try and tell someone else what to do. And so I think they would have just had to learn on the job again.
Because I'm actually interested, because it must have been a very strange experience, say, for some sergeants who would be more experienced pilots, maybe, when an officer arriving.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in the air, I imagine you're very much equal in that kind of environment.
Well, I may have happened, I think, in one squadron, not, I don't mean number one squadron, but in one squadron, that a sergeant pilot did lead a flight or something like that. But basically, no, officer rank, an officer led. But, of course, later in the war, when I was still a sergeant, I came up against this, and I was very, very cross about it later on in the war. Before, in Malta, it irritated me a lot.